Hello, everyone. My name is Nora Peel. I'm the Deputy Director of the Boston Book Festival. Thank you so much for joining us here today. I'd especially like to thank our presenting partner, 90.9 WBUR, for their support of the Boston Book Festival. We rely on sponsors and partners like WBUR to help us keep the festival free to everyone. But we also receive more than a third of our funding from individual donors just like you, many of them making donations of $150 or less. This year, we're hoping you can join these donors by giving what you can and helping to keep the festival free to all. This year, instead of the ubiquitous survey cards that you probably saw in the past, we've instead given you a handy-dandy envelope tucked right into your program guide. It's still a survey, and you can still fill it out and have a chance to win an iPad mini, but it's also your opportunity to help us cover all the big and little expenses that go along with presenting a free festival like this. Speaking of that program guide, did you know that it costs us nearly $3 per copy to design and produce the program guide that you were handed for free today? Maybe you'd like to help pay for your copy by slipping a few dollars into the envelope before dropping it in the survey box on your way out today. Or maybe you'd like to get more involved by stopping by our membership table, where we have lots of enticements to encourage you to get more involved. Either way, we thank you for your support. And now I'm pleased to introduce Christopher Lydon, host of Open Source on WBUR, and our guide through the end times during today's fiction session. Thank you.
Are we ready? Are we ready for the end times? We're in church anyway. We begin with this word apocalypse, very old word with a very modern currency, but it's from the Greek, meaning a kind of lifting of veils, most famous for St. John of Patmos, but a glimpse of the end times. And it's all around us, very current form for fiction writing. I remember interviewing P.D. James on her book, The Children of Men. Do you remember that? Mm-hmm. When the fertility just started going. Maybe my favorite is Will Smith in I Am Legend. But then there was always the great Invasion of the Body Snatchers, too. We're talking this morning with two wonderfully original authors in this general, I won't call it a genre, but a something that's part of all of our imaginations. And I'd like to ask both Emily St. John Mandel and Sandra Newman first to just locate us a little bit as to who they are, but why the apocalypse for them?
Sure, absolutely.
Emily.
So the apocalypse. Originally, Station 11 was going to be set entirely in the present day. I'm interested in film and theater, and I was interested in writing about the lives of actors as a way of looking at what it means to devote your life to your art. But I found that I also wanted to write about the modern world. And of course, one way to write about something is to contemplate its absence. So I came about the apocalypse in sort of a roundabout way, one way of considering the spectacular apparatus of technology that surrounds us. Is to write about what the world looks like if that's very suddenly stripped away. Hmm. So I decided to keep that original idea of writing about the lives of actors, but set it in a post-apocalyptic landscape for that reason. So in Station 11, we have the traveling Shakespearean theater company touring the Midwest 20 years after a flu has wiped out almost everything.
Hmm. A new way to see the world from the standpoint of death. Sandra, how'd you get there?
I've always been fascinated by post-apocalyptic fiction. I've read it since I was a child, so there was no... In a sense, I didn't arrive at it. I was already there. But when I was writing my book, like a lot of my book, people often like lazily call it dystopian fiction, which of course it is not. And you generally find post-apocalyptic novels being described as dystopian fictions, regardless of whether they involve a dystopia. And I actually think of it as a utopian fiction in that... It kind of is sort of born from one of the most appealing sides of post-apocalyptic fiction is that we're allowed to finally be free of the society in which we feel trapped. which I think it's like also a very strong element in Station 11. And so in my book, we don't have the present day at all. We're just in this world, which results 100 years after the apocalypse has happened. And in some ways, it's very dark, but in a lot of ways, it's much freer than our contemporary world. And I think a lot of post-apocalyptic fictions are sort of about that. There's a wish fulfillment element that we do not have to go to an office. We do not feel like wedded to knowing about the Kardashians, whatever it is that we find disgusting right. and tiresome right. about our everyday lives. It's just completely gone, and we didn't have to do anything to achieve that.
Well, you speak of reading apocalyptic fiction from childhood. What were your faves?
Oh, now I'm trying to think. This is when, whenever anyone asks me to name a book.
Tell like, a funny joke right away.
Book, and then as soon as books. The panel's over, you remember 10, right? That's the way
exactly, yeah. exactly. I'll yeah. be... Can you think of one?
I read A Canticle for Leibowitz when I was about 15 by, what was his name, Walter Miller? I think it came out in 1960. And Station 11 is very different, but that's the first post-apocalyptic book that I remember that really made an impression on me as a young teen. So that one in particular stands out for me. But,
yeah. All I can remember is a really cheesy B-movie, which I think was called Population Zero, where the plague not only killed people, but it reduced them to dust, which, of course, as a child, this was totally terrifying to me. You'd right. find these, like, piles of dust in the rumpled clothes.
So melodramatic. That's amazing. yeah.
I would ask you both, if you would, to read no more than a page, but a taste of this afterworld,
sure.
the end times.
Sure, absolutely.
Emily, would you start?
Absolutely. This is a about a two-minute section from Station 11. The book moves back and forth in time, and this is from a point in the book when the world, as we know it, is just beginning to come to an end. An incomplete list. No more diving into pools of chlorinated water lit green from below. No more ball games played out under floodlights. No more porch lights with moths fluttering on summer nights. No more trains running under the surface of cities on the dazzling power of the electric third rail. No more cities. No more films, except rarely, except with a generator drowning out half the dialogue. And only then for the first little while, until the fuel for the generators ran out, because automobile gas goes stale after 2 or 3 years. No more screens shining in the half-light as people raise their phones above the crowd to take photographs of concert stages. No more concert stages lit by candy-colored halogens. No more electronica, punk, electric guitars. No more flight. No more towns glimpsed from the sky through airplane windows, points of glimmering light. No more looking down from 30,000 feet and imagining the lives lit up by those lights at that moment. No more airplanes. No more requests to put your tray table in its upright and locked position. But no, this wasn't true. There were still airplanes here and there. They stood dormant on runways. They collected snow on their wings. In the cold months, they were ideal for food storage. Rust blossomed and streaked. No more countries, all borders unmanned. No more fire departments, no more police. No more road maintenance or garbage pickup. No more internet. No more social media. No more scrolling through litanies of dreams and nervous hopes and photographs of lunches. Cries for help and expressions of contentment and relationship status updates with heart icons whole or broken. Plans to meet up later. Pleas, complaints, desires, pictures of babies dressed as bears or peppers for Halloween. No more reading and commenting on the lives of others, and in so doing, feeling slightly less alone in the room. No more avatars. It's most of chapter 6 of Station 11.
It feels like a time capsule.
It does, doesn't it? Mm. Yeah, and it's... an extraordinary thing that I found about writing a post-apocalyptic book, and I'd be curious to know if it was the same for you, is how much our current world feels like science fiction, if you think about what it would be like to try to explain it to somebody who'd never seen it, that there was this time when we could talk to people on the far side of the earth with handheld devices, which we called phones, but were actually supercomputers, that you could cross the Atlantic Ocean in 6 hours and know when a hurricane was coming. You know, these details that we kind of take for granted that really are kind of spectacular, aren't they?
Yeah, I think in my book, they've gone so far beyond that, that they and have no memory of it, that it becomes that thing where, you know, any sufficiently advanced science is indistinguishable from magic. So.
Right, right, yeah.
Simply perceive anything like that as magic.
Sandra's book is in an halfway invented language or dialect of English. I can't wait to hear it in your voice.
Oh, I don't read it very well, actually. So you'll be prepared. You know, it's much better on the page. This will be like a...
It's hard on the page, let me tell you.
Shadow.
That is beautiful.
But worth it.
Thank you. Okay, so mostly this is in the voice of the heroine, who is named Ice Cream Star, or Ice Cream 15 Star. In her culture, they have their age in the middle of the name. And one thing to know, which might help it be a little more comprehensible in the patois in real time, is that in this world, I think this is mentioned in the program, everybody dies before they reach the age of 20. So this is kind of a theme in the beginning. Okay. My name be Ice Cream 15 Star. My brother be Driver 18 Star, and my ghost brother Mojack 5 Star, dead when I myself was only 6 years old. Still my heart is rain for him, my brother dead of posies little. My mother and my grands and my great-grands been single pure. Our people be a tarry night sort, and we skinny and long. My brother Driver climb a tree with only hands, because our bones so light, our muscles 40 strong. We flee like a dragonfly over water. We fight like 10 guns, and we be bell to sea. Other children go deranged and unpredictable for our love. We singles be a wandering sort. We never grow nothing from anything, never had no tato patch nor cornfield. Be thieves and brave to hunt. A sengal hungry even when he eat, even when he rich, he still want to grab and rob, he hungry for something he ain't never seen nor thought of. We was so proud, we was ridiculous as wild animals, but we was bell and strong. In my greats time, we come up from Chespy Water, was living peaceful by two towns until the neck-faced murderers come. Then we flee onward to these massa woods. Here we thieve well. We live as long as Lowell's, sometimes 20 years or 21 years. Every single have a knife, and we together possess two guns. Driver got a gun that shoot, and Crow 16 a broken shotgun, still is good for scaring. This day my story start, we've been out scratching in the evacs. These evacs be house after house, that face each other in twin lines. Houses shamble down and rotten. Yeah, the road between is broken through with pushing weeds. Get 50 houses in a street, and 20 streets in 1 hour's walking. When these houses all was full, it'd been more people here than squirrels. Ain't nobody living now. Loot here be older, but is rich. We find every kind of thing. Pharmacies, canned food, clothes. Find cigarettes, be old, with mushroom taste, but still can smoke. What I love most, can of beefaroni. I eat that cold. I eat beefaroni anyway. The person invented beefaroni, that person was a valuable genius. I think I'll leave it there.
Leave him laughing, always. These strike me as intimately related. You both spoke of imagining life from a vantage point of death or some entirely different place. I had a very strange and disquieting experience yesterday. Somebody very, very, very close to me told me that she had been examined, brain MRI, and she might just have an aneurysm in her incredibly healthy head and midlife, you know, fullness of life. And suddenly, I know for her and for me and lots of others who love her, it's putting yourself right into that place where you are. completely alien, different, possibly alienated look at the life we live, where it came with all this technology, where it would go with us or without us. You're seeing things fresh. I imagine, I presume to say, Emily, in your book, you're trying to see from that vantage point what is beautiful, what was beautiful, what is essentially for you beautiful, for individuals
Absolutely.
Beautiful. And if I may just, I'll come to you, Sandra, but it seems to me your book is about, wow, in a radically different, from a different perspective, what is love? What is loving? What are the human connections? But am I close? Starting with you, Emily, about your list of idiosyncratic things that you find exquisite.
Absolutely. You are right. The one thing I would say, though, is that the last part of that chapter where I'm talking about Facebook, I would not miss Facebook. But as a generalization for the way I've tried to approach the modern world in this book, you're absolutely correct. It is essentially a love letter. It's an effort on my part to try to see the world around me. You know, it's so easy to forget that it actually is somewhat extraordinary that we live in a time when you can flip a switch on the wall and the room is flooded by electric light, to note just one very tiny thing that we take for granted to the extent that we don't even see it, except after winter storms when the power goes out. Mm. We are surrounded by similarly extraordinary things. Writing Station 11 was a way for me to see those things and perhaps to see the world more sharply. And it is in thinking about loss that we do see those things very sharply. Whether it's people we know and love who are suddenly in peril, or whether it's thinking about a fictional world where all of this that we take for granted has fallen away. Mm. So yeah, you're absolutely correct. That was what I was thinking of.
Mm. Sandra, how does that apply to you and the sense of people reflecting on love and sex, but real love too, and what was it about?
What was love about in the book?
Yeah,
it's sort of in this book. It's in a sneaky way a very political book, and since it's from the point of view of a 15-year-old who's very naive, you know. In her own terms, in the terms of her society, she's very canny and politically aware, but her world, she starts out in a group of 38 people, so it's a very different viewpoint. And then she gradually, in attempting to save her people like from the disease that kills them when they're 18, she increasingly enters larger and larger political, I can't think of the word, but basically it opens up until she's dealing with geopolitics. And a lot of the book, like, as it develops, is about the clash between her trying to immediately save the people she loves and has known since she was born, her brother primarily, and how that eventually means that she is asked to take a much larger people, an entire city, to war. And so it's this sort of clash, which I think is present to all of us in our everyday lives, between the interests of our children, primarily. I mean, with her, it's her brother, but it's usually your children. Like, do I get an SUV to make it easier to bring my children to school, even though that means, in some subtle sense, like, for her, it's a huge sense. She's the immediate person making the decision, but for each of us in our everyday lives, we constantly choose our families and ourselves over the world, or choose the world over ourselves and our families. And this is actually the essence of a lot of our moral lives, our ethical lives. And it is like the clash between ethics and love, where love can become a deeply unethical emotion. Mm. That's what it eventually is. But the book is sort of powered by her love for people, and it eventually turns out that love can be a very dark thing.
Mm. Dare I ask, where did it come from in your own thinking, your reflection, your own life growing up, your own life today?
Well, it's actually... the book, it immediately came from... I mean, the whole trope of people dying when they're 18 came from, I had an experience where three of my closest friends from the time when I was a teenager died in a short period of time. So the book is born out of the feeling of grief and that kind of love, the very pure love you have for somebody who you've lost. So that's where it really comes from. And it's kind of, you know, it's sort of a Gilgamesh tale where she's going forth to try to defeat death, which was what I would like to have been able to do at that time.
Mm. I'd like to ask you both, this is a session on apocalyptic novels, which is a sort of book festival convention, maybe. Are you in the same game, or is this just a programming accident?
That's a great question.
Do you read each other's work? Do you know
yeah,
where each other are coming from?
I loved Ice Cream Star. we do read each other's work.
Yes,
absolutely. Yeah. You know, I don't know. I'm not sure that I would write another book, though, in the apocalyptic genre, whereas I know that you're working on, is it a trilogy ultimately? Then
I was working on a sequel to this, mm-hmm. but I'm writing another apocalyptic book.
No right.
That's,
right.
I just like became obsessed with it.
Right.
With
so this might just be a moment of convergence in our careers.
Yeah.
right. Thematically speaking. Yeah. I feel personally that I've felt said everything I wanted to say about the end of the world. So I'm not, you know, and spent enough time there, frankly. I'm not sure if any of my future books will involve.
I was going to say, would you say that apocalyptic fiction has a future?
I love that question. It seems that it does. I mean, you certainly see wave upon wave of post-apocalyptic novels in every publishing catalog. It's quite extraordinary these last few years. On the other hand, I think vampire fiction is pretty much burnt out. So I'm not sure that these have endless shelf lives, you know, as a genre. You hope that the books you love best in a particular genre will survive and there'll be more like them. But yeah, I do wonder if we'll always be as interested in post-apocalyptic fiction as we are now. It does seem like a curious moment when it's particularly popular.
Hmm. We'll go to questions from the audience, please, in a moment. But just before we do, before apocalyptic fiction, who would you say was your favorite character in all of English language fiction?
Not to put me on the spot. My favorite character in all of English language fiction, Esme from the Salinger short story to Esme with Love and Squalor.
With Love and Squalor, of
I'd
course.
Have to point to her.
Mm-hmm. And why?
Her spirit. She was a sense of self-sufficiency and self-determination and very sharp intelligence. Perhaps in a milieu when it's not particularly expected of her. You know, she's a little girl in an upper-crust family, and nobody expects, you know, the 7-year-old in church choir to be an intellectual giant, but an unexpected quality to her intelligence, I suppose that's what it comes down to.
Mm. Sandra?
Just off the top of my head, I think Maddie from True Grit, the narrator of True Grit, who's just she's not the nicest person in the world. She's the person you'd want to become like, but she's a fantastic narrator.
Mm. Thank you. And questions are welcome. Very brief comments. I mean, bumper sticker comments, but questions too.
Have you read The Road, Cormac McCarthy's book? That's a post-apocalyptic novel that just got into my conscience, and I was dreaming about it. And I just thought it was incredibly powerful. And any comments you have on that one?
Sure, absolutely. I loved The Road. This is a strange thing to say about a novel that one loves, but I did think of The Road, though, as a kind of negative example when I was writing Station 11, that as much as I love that novel and respect McCarthy's achievement with it, I didn't want to write it. I feel like that since that novel, that territory of mayhem and chaos and horror has been so well covered by so many other writers. So for me, it was more interesting to imagine what comes after the world of The Road. I feel that mayhem's not a sustainable way of life over decades and generations. So what's the new culture and the new world that begins to emerge after that? But yeah, it's an extraordinary book.
Cindy?
Okay. I hesitate to say this, but I did not like The Road. And so, but I, you know, I would say, like, I understand why anybody would love it because of the extraordinary incantatory beauty of Cormac McCarthy's language, which is at its sort of pinnacle in that book. But I found that apart from that, it was a bit Johnny One Note, if you, and sort of as a person who's been reading post-apocalyptic literature all my life, it felt as if he was using the tropes that are familiar to me, but not in a particularly creative way. And so I almost thought it was a waste of his powers, but that was my personal reaction. Of course, you can.
Okay. Please.
To get to your comments about this particular moment in our culture, it does seem to me there's a proliferation of this genre, especially not just in books, but in movies, that is so dark. And I watched, what's that zombie series, The Walking Dead, and I just couldn't watch it after. I mean, it's just so bleak. And I wonder if this genre is proliferating either due to or perpetuating this sort of bleak view of our future, and whether where that comes from and whether it's healthy.
Right. Well, I've heard a lot of theories during a fairly long tour for Station 11 on why we're drawn to this fiction. And that idea comes up a lot, that perhaps we're drawn to it as a natural expression of the anxiety we feel at this fraught world in which we find ourselves. And that's an intuitive argument, but the counter argument is, when have we ever felt like the world wasn't ending? You know, it's kind of interesting. You think about the obvious moments in our history that must have seemed quite fraught and terrifying, the First and the Second World Wars, the Spanish Flu. But what's even more interesting to me is that we seem to feel as though the end is nigh, even in moments that seem as though they would have been quite tranquil, at least in retrospect. I had a conversation with my mother once where she mentioned in passing that she and her friends had felt somewhat guilty bringing children into the world in the late 70s and early 80s in Western Canada. And it's hard to imagine a more tranquil time or place, but that was the height of the Cold War. So I think it's some kind of pessimism / narcissism on our part that we want to believe we're living at the climax of the story. It's the end of history. I've heard some interesting theories about why we're drawn to this fiction. One I've been thinking about recently, personally, kind of goes back to what Sandra was saying at the beginning, which is that I think we have a deep ambivalence about our technology. You know, I think that perhaps we secretly long for a world where we're not absolutely tethered and accountable to these devices and emails and contacts and keeping up and updating. It might be as simple as that, you know, as longing for a simpler life, I suppose.
Yeah, I think there are a few things, a couple of which you've covered, and one which people don't talk about that much is just that our lives, like, despite all of the things that we find to be terrified about, our lives are so safe, like incredibly safe, from a historical perspective. And we are animals that are designed to deal with a lot of danger and to survive against all odds. So we enjoy fantasies in which we are again asked to survive against all odds. And so, not to go back, okay, I'm going to go back to my book.
Please.
It is, again, sort of returning to that hunter-gatherer reality in which you're surviving against all odds. And that's true of almost all of these, all post-apocalyptic narratives, including The Walking Dead, although they don't survive, of course. But
Thank you. Thanks for the question. Please.
Emily brought up, can you all hear me?
Yep.
Okay.
Close to the mic.
Emily brought up the sort of questioning how long of a shelf life the post-apocalyptic genre has. But on the other hand, there are certainly books in that genre that have stood the test of time. You brought up Canticle for Leibowitz. Mm-hmm. So my question is, what makes a book in the post-apocalyptic genre survive?
Sounds like you're writing one.
Right. It's like guilty as charged. I can't write. I don't know. I mean, you like to think that the books that will survive are, this is so subjective, but the best ones. You know, A Canticle for Leibowitz had such originality about it. So I could easily imagine a time when not every publishing catalog is full of books about the end of the world. But perhaps at the same time, the books that were well written about the end of the world will survive, or at least that's my hope as a reader.
Yeah, I was having that same hope as you began to speak. And I think there's also one of the most long-lived apocalypse narratives is that of Noah, of course. And if you think about it, children love that story. And adults love that story, and it's partly because you have the end of the world and you have the very satisfying idea that everyone but you is bad and should be destroyed, but you and your family will be preserved and guided by God. But also there's the saving of the animals, which is such a powerful idea and such a great trope. So those sorts of things take a narrative to a different level.
Wonderful. Wonderful to think of Noah as an apocalyptic novel. Of course it is. Please.
This is for Emily. Something that I really loved about Station 11 is that you give us more than one present day. So with Jeevan and Kirsten, they're before the plague, and then we also get to hear about their story after the plague. And in both instances, it's still their present. And yet with Kirsten, there's this huge black hole of her as a child, and you reference it, and we know that it traumatized her and made her really strong. But what drew you to giving characters two versions of present, and then what did you know what happened to her and think about it, but what reason did you give for not explaining it to us?
Right. So for anybody who hasn't read the book, there's a character, Kirsten, who survives the event, and there's a year of her life that she doesn't remember at all right after it happened. Oh, to the first part of the question, I was just trying to create the most full and well-rounded characters possible. So by giving them lives in different points of time, that was an interesting way to do that. Mm-hmm. Also for continuity, to go from the pre-apocalyptic to the post-apocalyptic sections of the book. I liked the idea of at least some characters having lives in both the before and the after. I never spelled out, even to myself, exactly what happened to her in that last year, partly because I didn't want to write The Road. That was, I was imagining it as a year of absolute terror and nightmarish things. And I think that sometimes horror can be best rendered by suggestion. Mm-hmm. You know, that you can suggest a horrific event, and that can almost be more effective sometimes, in my opinion, than spelling it out and then showing you the blood spatters.
Yeah. Thank you.
Hi, Emily. A second ago, you characterized post-apocalyptic books as end-of-the-world books, but I actually think what gives them staying power as opposed to, vampire novels would be that they're sort of beginning-of-the-world books, in a way. And particularly your novel, I think, seems very hopeful. And so sort of to Sandra's point about post-apocalyptic fiction being a way to escape this world and imagine a totally different one, don't you think that those books are really just as much about new worlds and that will give them a sort of longer shelf life?
I do think that. Yeah. No, it's an interesting point. And I definitely saw that in your book, that, there is a feeling of the possibility of a new world happening.
Do you want to expand?
Oh, in terms of, to very varying degrees. Some of them really are about the end of the world, and it's this kind of horror porn about the end of the world, and then others are trying to imagine what other kinds of society might arise, more or less optimistically.
Yeah.
Hi. So this question comes from reading Station 11, but it's not just limited to Emily. But I really enjoyed in Station 11 how you have all of these really complex characters who don't necessarily meet each other, but are linked to each other and create this world. So as a reader, you see this big, beautiful picture of how Miranda's drawings impact these people in the apocalypse. And you're just building eventually to this moment in the end where you have so much compassion for the character that you've sort of seen as the villain or the evil one throughout. Even the people in our modern time who are they're very complex and very interesting. And I'm wondering if you can talk about that and the linkage of the characters and just your general character development as you're writing an apocalyptic story.
Sure, absolutely. It was important to me for the characters in Station 11 to be linked in some way, because I knew that the book would be structurally fairly complicated, you know, in terms of these wild jumps back and forth in time and multiple points of view. So I saw that as being the function of the character Arthur, who dies in the first chapter. He is in some ways a major character, and we get a little bit of his lives, but I saw him as being more importantly a kind of dark star, you know, around which, a sort of black hole around which all of the other characters revolve. So that was the most important way of linking them. And then I was also thinking about linking them by way of objects, that there's a comic book and a paperweight that serve as sort of through lines through the structure of the novel that are passed from hand to hand and from character to character.
My question is about sadness. So, and I think it applies a lot to this genre, but really to any story. And so how do you decide when are the right moments for something tragic and awful to happen, or for a character to die or have something really brutal to happen to them, versus needing a moment of uplift or to keep your reader from, like, totally giving up on the story? So how do you balance sort of tragedy or those decisions in books like this?
That's a really good question. I mean, it's something that I dealt with a lot in this book, because I felt from the beginning it was such a sad book. And I was always trying to write scenes in which the characters were happy and having a good time and had something good happen, and almost all of those scenes ended up on the cutting room floor. So it's sort of interesting. You think of, like, an experience that you have in real life can very, very easily become relentless, you know, almost there are entire months of one's life which are composed almost entirely of such experiences. But in a book, you want vitally challenging things to be happening to the characters, or at least for them to be feeling vitally challenging things at all times. So you have to find the positive stuff from somewhere else. It needs to be in the way that they deal with those tragic events. That was certainly true of this book. I think it's also true of Station 11.
Yeah, you know, you sacrifice so much to velocity. You'll have all of these scenes, and the, you know, whether or not you're trying to explicitly lighten up your fairly dark narrative, and so much ends up on the cutting room floor. But something I love about your book is there are these little flashes of humor. You know, there are some wonderful lines in there, and real brightness.
Yeah. Please.
Hi, this question is for Emily. I was very interested in the start of your novel about how you choose to have King Lear as the entrance into this piece. And I'm just wondering what it is about that play that inspired you, or, you know, kind of worked with your narrative, or, you know, what themes in there you sort of drew from.
Right. So it's partly just that Lear is my favorite of the Shakespeare plays. It's partly that as I was, around the time I was thinking about this book, when I first started writing it, I read a fascinating oral history of the public theater in New York City. And in amidst all of these anecdotes, came across this story someone was telling to the effect of, do you guys remember that time that actor died of a heart attack in the fourth act of King Lear? You know, as a novelist, you see something like that, and you think, that's an opener. That would be a really gripping way to open my novel about actors. And because I knew it was going to be nonlinear, because that's my favorite way to write books, I knew that I could then go back and get more of that actor's life. But I think most importantly, it's that, you know, of course, on one level, Lear is a play about losing absolutely everything. And as such, it struck me as the perfect play for that moment in the plot, that this is a sort of suspended last moment of normal world. A pandemic is just arriving in North America, but nobody really knows it yet. Nobody knows that within hours or days, they'll have lost absolutely everything. So they're kind of together in this magical last moment. And so a play about losing everything seemed appropriate for that moment in the plot.
Sandra, Greg?
No,
yeah, you just hold the line one sec. You spoke a moment ago of sort of lightening up, and I'm thinking you also spoke of, you know, this eternal, maybe inherent in our DNA, expectation of the worst, the end, late 70s, early 80s, or whenever, Noah's time, etc. And I'm also, and our technology and ISIS and more nuclear weaponry floating in the oceans today in these Ohio-class submarines than was ever exploded all the firepower ever exploded in World War II, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All these awful, awful things. And along comes our friend Steve Pinker, MIT, now Harvard, with this book called The Better Angels of Our Nature, saying, no, in fact, war casualties are down, murder is down, rape is down, child abuse is down, spanking is down. We're getting closer and closer to Candide's heaven than we've ever been. How does that possibility, if it is such, play in a novelist's mind, in the kind of imagination that you both have?
That possibility.
The possibility that, hey, we're around the corner from paradise.
It's actually, I think, because of that sadness, the necessity of sadness in a novel, that possibility isn't that useful to a novelist, unfortunately. It's more like a threat to us in our professional capacity. I think that's unfortunately true. And when you get the science fiction novel set in that sort of utopian, like the culture novels of Ian Banks, for instance, like it's a world, the base society of them is more or less perfect and there is no violence and so on. Well, it's always about some other society that they go to, which is hyper-violent and horrible. That's what you need to write, I think.
That's interesting. No, I mean, I love that idea that we're always around the corner from a miraculous utopia and we always think the world's ending, because that does seem to be the way we're wired to think. And I guess it would be a threat to our livelihood if everything were absolutely fine. But everything will never be absolutely fine, because there will always be individual tragedies and individual tensions and nightmares being played out.
Keep thinking. I'll be interested to see if there's a germ in this sort of paradise.
Right.
Thank you. And thanks for letting me jump in. Please.
Hi. Going off of the limits of this sort of McCarthyian mayhem or the horror porn like you were talking about, I was wondering what your thoughts were on the potential for this genre to explore how funny all of this can be in sort of tearing apart the context of all of these objects in our modern world and recontextualizing them in the way that just shows the absurdity in a humorous way. I mean, you were talking about these glimmers of humor, and I just wanted to get your thoughts. Like, the beefaroni, that's great. Beefaroni.
Yeah, there's a lot of that in my book, which is partly because I kind of cheat by having one part of civilization survive so that my character can encounter it. And it's that sort of trope of an innocent encountering our world and finding it absurd and lamentably stupid and being and not understanding a telephone and whatever it is.
Yeah, but I think it's safe to say that neither of us are humor writers. You know, we're we have picked a fairly dark subject. I guess there is real potential for humor. I find myself thinking of this post on Reddit a few years ago. It was to the effect of, I think the subject was, if a time traveler from the past were to come to our time, what would be the thing about this world that's the most difficult to explain? And the one that got the most upvotes was, I hold in my hand a device that holds all of human knowledge. I use it to get into arguments with strangers and look at pictures of cats. So, you know, it is absolutely absurd to think about, the way our technology could juxtapose, you know, in a world where there isn't that technology. I think maybe we point to have a few moments like that in both of our lives, you know, in both of our books, I mean, the beefaroni and then the section in Station 11 where they're talking about the ridiculousness of the corporate language that we use every day, you know, the THX instead of thanks, like those moments. But I can't say I'm super drawn to writing humorous books about it.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Can you hear me? All right.
Yes.
Okay. So going off what a few people have said, like how we put all this, like myself included, we all write about all this horror and strife and like truly messed up things. With our characters, we use that to like help them evolve to like being better people than people we randomly know. So how much hope do you think you're allowed to give people in these situations?
it maybe depends on both the character you're writing about and the situation. Would you agree?
Yeah, I mean, you can use hope in different ways. Like, it's possible, like, if you create the most seemingly hopeless situation, but then somehow create an amazing scope for hope, like the possibility of a utopian situation coming out of a post-apocalyptic situation, then that's a hugely strong premise. But you also don't need that if there's something
right
else in the book. So it's sort of one of those questions where the answer could be different depending on the book.
Yeah, and I think that's right.
Hey.
Did you want, you know, I meant hope of what in your own head? What constitutes hope?
Again, I think that's something that's subjective. Right. Hope for a future life, mm-hmm. to worlds where world you can look forward to.
The world seems
to look forward to. It seems to me that hope's implicit in a lot of post-apocalyptic books. You know, it's even The Road. You know, at the very end, the boy is taken up by essentially good people, and in that, there's some hope. You know, on a very small level. You know, in Sandra's book, she's trying to create a better world. That's her whole mission, to try to cure this, to find a cure for this disease. And on Station 11, there is sort of the possibility held out that the world is beginning to change. So I think you see it baked into the premises of a lot of these books, I would say, would you?
Okay, I'm going to hijack this to tell
sure,
a funny
yeah.
story.
Yeah, please.
Okay. So my husband is fascinated by books and stories that are hopelessness narratives, which is what he calls them. Like, I'm not, if anybody has read Harlan Ellison's I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream, that's like the classic hopelessness narrative where there are only a few people left and they're being kept by this computer, that like all-powerful supercomputer that has godlike powers just to torture them. Mm. And that's all he does. He just tortures, it just tortures them and they can't die, so it just goes on forever. And so I have no mouth and I must scream.
That's crazy.
So my husband is fascinated by these, and there was one point, one of these Thomas Dish's The Genocides, he was like 20 years old, and he had been up all night reading The Genocides and taking acid. And because this was long enough ago, it so happened Thomas Dish lived in New York, so he just looked in the phone book like at 6 in the morning and found Thomas Dish and called him on the phone and said, "Man, how do you live with that vision of the world?" Apparently, Thomas Dish was very, very gracious and like talked him down. So, yes, young man, it's a novel, and so that's my story about that.
Interesting.
Interesting. You look crazy. I like it.
Please, thank you.
Hi, I was curious about your respective writing processes and what doubts came up for you, and how did you overcome them?
Do you want me to go first?
There's no real process, to be totally honest. I just sit down and write. I always have moments of doubt in every book I've written where, you know, it's such a roller coaster in terms of your relationship with your work. Or one day you look at what you've written, you think, you know, I think I've got something here. And then the next day you read the same text and think, wow, I've just wasted a year and a half of my life. Like, what was I thinking? There is always a fear that you can't pull it off. The project you've taken on is too ambitious. Or there is for me, anyway. It helps to remember that I felt that way with all of my previous books, and it worked out okay. So there is a certain cumulative confidence over the years. In terms of process, I don't know. I write whenever I can. I had a day job until 2 months ago as an administrative assistant in a cancer research lab. So my life for years and years and years has been a matter of writing whenever possible in the margins of whatever I was doing to pay my rent. And the job's gone now, but I'm still on tour. So now, you know, I write in hotel rooms and airports. I just write whenever I can and hope that it's good.
Good.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that there does come a point. Life is so demanding, and you just write whenever someone isn't stopping you.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm. Thank you. Good question.
My question's directed at Sandra. I read Ridley Walker a few years ago and was really struck by the author's decision to write in what struck me as a limited language. And I wanted to know whether your decision to write your book in your style, you arrived at that decision at the book's conception, and what drove that motivation.
I read Ridley Walker when I was 18 or something like that, and Clockwork Orange, actually, during the same cross-country bus trip. So obviously it rooted in my brain in a particular way. But the decision, it's sort of interesting because I never, even when I began to do it, I had that moment of a crisis of confidence. Can I do this? Will anybody bear with me while I do this? But once you get into it, like, it seems like a limited language at first, and it has limitations. But after a while, you realize that being allowed to invent your own words and create your own locutions, it actually frees you up a lot more than standard English, where all those decisions have already been made for you, and you have to work within them to a much larger degree. It's much harder to break out of the way everybody says things without coming across as foppish and ridiculous. And so, now I'm not sure if I'm answering your question.
Yes, yeah, totally, yeah. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Good. Good. So now, like, facing the end of that, it's very hard for me to go back to using English.
Mm. Wow. Yeah, right. Well, we may come back to that. That's an interesting thought.
Is there something about young women in general that makes them good central points for these stories about the future, about the responsibility they feel or the turmoil of what will my life be and all these different options ahead of them and needing to, I don't know, take accountability for what's next?
That's a good question. I don't know. I don't know if young women are different in that regard from young men, you know, broadly speaking, that the young men I've known over the years have, it seems to me, have sort of found themselves at a sort of similar point, you know, in that time of their lives. Like, what will my life be? What can I make of myself? What kind of person will I be? I'd be curious to know. What's your experience been?
I thought about it a lot. I was thinking of writing something about it, but ultimately I came to the conclusion that it was impossible to pin something down that actually was a difference between a young male and a young female protagonist. Except from the reader's point of view, like, we are kind of indoctrinated to think of women as more vulnerable, so you get that little bit more drama out of it.
Right, there's a little more physical risk.
Exactly.
Right.
Like, if they have to fight somebody and they win, they're automatically the underdog. Oh my God, she won.
Right, right. So, that's interesting. That. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. Yeah.
Please, if there's a last question, we want to hear it. I want to ask the second last question, just going back a sec, but please, some brave soul, come forward and ask the last one. Two brave souls, but let me just get... before you go, I'd love you to expand a little bit. It's a very tempting thought that if you broke into a different sound, different rhythm, different vocabulary, scrambled it, kind of double talk, you might end up with something Casey Stengelis or, you know, something really, really both profound and individual and interesting, musical, different, poetic. Coach us.
Coach you? Oh, I have no idea. I have no idea how I did it. I mean, the people ask me, how long did it take you to come up with the language? And it was about 2 hours. And then I was writing it. And the
were you talking it? Were you talking it to your family and your husband all the time?
No, it's funny. Like, I was, like, I still sometimes in my head use some of the phrases, and there was a point when I was never sure whether a phrase was really English that I was using. So towards the end, actually, yes, I said no, and I meant yes. But it's sort of, it's just an extension of what all people do when they try to write poetically. That you're trying to break out of, like, there's a Russian literary term for this, which is translates as making strange, which is one of the basic things that authors.
But we're always railing against received language, received opinion, received this. So throw it all away and start again.
Yeah, you're trying to create a nuance or a combination of meanings that was not there before, that is new to the reader, that makes them see things in a different way. Mm. So this is really just the same thing. It's just a way of doing it in a concentrated way, and there's a justification for it.
Can we try it at home? I mean, is this...
Oh, absolutely. Everybody should try it at home. It's really... Okay. It's great fun.
Thank you. Two last questions, please.
Okay. So I find that I don't really like post-apocalyptic fiction when it's like really fantastical, kind of Hunger Games type of, like, you know, society thing. But I really do enjoy it when it's just a bunch of people trying to survive. Like, I really liked the Susan Beth Pfeiffer, The End of the World as We Knew It, and Strangelets. I forget who wrote that. But, you know, just books about, like, the end of the world comes, sort of, and it's, like, almost like how it could happen.
Right.
I was wondering, I know you're not, like, you've both seemed very well-read, and I was just wondering if you had any kind of recommendations for that part of the genre.
Yeah, there's a book that I very much love called The Dog Stars by Peter Heller. It's great, right? And one of the reasons why I went with Knopf as my U.S. publisher was it was an opportunity to work with Peter Heller's editor. And the reason I read that book was because I'd written a draft of Station 11, and then a friend said to me, I just read this great book. It's post-apocalyptic. It's also literary. The world ends because of a flu, and they're living in an airport. I was like, oh, my God. It was completely different from Station 11, which I was happy about. But no, it's just the most beautifully written literary novel that happens to be set. I think it's about 10 or 15 years after a flu pandemic. And you get that sense of people trying to survive. It's not a dystopian situation.
Mm. Yeah, I can't think of the only book I can think of right now, which is very much a science fiction novel called The Water Knife, which I thought was really interesting. It's not a full apocalypse, but it's an envisioning of what will happen to the cities of the Southwest as the aquifers are exhausted. And there just is simply is no potable water, and entire cities are dying. And that is very much, very realistic, very much about imagining exactly how that will play out.
Hmm. Thank you. Last question.
Station 11 has a whole bunch of layers of fictions within fictions, and you said that it started out with you writing about actors, but there are also authors in the novel. So I was wondering, when writing sort of the graphic novel Station 11, do you engage in that story immediately as an author in the same way that you do the enveloping story, or are you aware of using it as a tool, as a reader? You know, we have different layers of encountering them. Do you have those different layers as author?
I did ultimately, but when I first started writing Station 11, I didn't realize how important that graphic novel would become in the book. I never work from an outline. I just kind of wing it. So originally, I was just thinking of what Miranda's art form would be. You know, I had a very clear idea of her as a character, practicing some kind of art at her desk, at her boring administrative day job. And I hit on graphic novels at first because I like the form. I think it's an exciting way to tell a story. So I wasn't even going to go into details of what that work was. But as I kept on revising, you know, that just became a more complex part of the story. And what I realized was that I could use the graphic novel as a tool, that I could use it to say things about the situation of the enveloping narrative. There's a sort of echo thematically where the graphic novel, you know, it's about characters marooned on a space station. And then, of course, the larger novel is about characters marooned in a strange new world. And I realized I could comment on one with the other. So, you know, because all genres are different, in a graphic novel, you can have a character say something like, I stood looking over my damaged home and tried to forget the sweetness of life on Earth. And you can't really just drop that into a novel or it's kind of cheesy, but I could... You know, I could make that comment about the larger story by means of the graphic novel. So yeah, it's a convoluted way of saying I did see those layers, but not until I was pretty far along in the revision process.
Sandra, you get the last word.
Oh.
No pressure.
The end or something like that.
Oh, the end. And thank you to everybody. You've been a great audience.
Thank you. Thank you.
I think we're even on time.